Liz is a freelance writer and preacher who also runs the UU Humor nonprofit Mirth and Dignity. She lives in Saskatoon with her two youngest sons and their new cat. Liz is a member of the Saskatoon Unitarians, has been to preach in Regina many times over the years, and also has a UU comedy podcast called The Cracked Pup that you can find on Facebook. We are so pleased to welcome you back today, Liz, to tell us a story of friendship. Since the age of 20, Liz has had friends from various countries in Africa. Many were refugees, and their relationship has often focused on helping them. But every time the two cultures mix, both parties learn things. Some of the biggest challenges we're facing right now, Liz says, would be helped significantly by employing some of the strategies she's learned in those cross-cultural relationships. So welcome, Liz.
Thanks, Joanne. Good morning, everybody. So one of the things that I did this year, you know, because you were part of helping me do it, was put together a recorded service for Flaming Chalice International, which is the organization founded by Reverend Fulgence Ndadjimana, who you also know. The service is filled with the stories that I think best explain the work of that organization, but there is a second set of stories. These are behind-the-scenes stories. Heads up, these are not organizational development stories. They're mostly not even international aid stories. These are friendship stories. When I was putting together the worship material for the official regular service, I re-interviewed Fulgence about some of the details of his story. I do this every couple of years for one reason or another, and one of the questions I always ask him is why he was thrown in prison. I'm hoping for a tidy answer when I ask this question, but I never get it. There were a lot of things going on at that time. It's not like the police showed up and said, "This is for the practice of your religion," and took him away. I always ask this question hoping for a soundbite, but the answer isn't a soundbite. The answer changes over time, too, as Fulgence's perspective on the situation changes. At first, his response was vague and laced with trauma and confusion. Later, it was bitter and reflected a growing anger at his government and the corrupt officials within it. This time, he talked about what he could have done differently in the time leading up to his arrest. He told me how, as his church grew in its connection with Western congregations, it amassed power, power in terms of donations, in terms of attention from and connection to the West. And as that power grew, he told me, he didn't do enough as the church's minister to connect with the people in government and reassure them, that the church wasn't a threat. He's never given me that answer before. When he said this, I immediately thought of the first time I met Reverend Fulgence when he was visiting the Canadian ministers during a retreat. And he and I talked quite a bit. I asked him a lot about Unitarianism as practiced in Burundi. There are a lot of differences in Unitarianism around the world. This is one of the things I love about us. I love that we change shape to suit local contexts and beliefs, but we see that as a good thing. But this does make it tricky to put your finger on exactly what holds us together. So I asked Fulgence about this. Given how different Burundian Unitarianism is, I said, what makes it still Unitarianism? And Fulgence spoke about a common commitment to freedom of conscience and reason and to justice and to people having a voice in the decisions that affect them. And then he smiled and he said that Unitarianism in Canada is very different than the Unitarianism he experienced in Burundi. And he asked me to tell him what I saw as the commonality and then asked me to explain what made Canadian Unitarianism still Unitarianism. And I had, as Westerners often do, centered my own perspective. Canadian Unitarianism was real Unitarianism as I saw it. And even though he and I had just met, he gently pointed this out to me. He didn't stick to telling me what I wanted to hear, even though the success of his fundraising efforts at the time, the success of getting medical care for families in his community, hinged on his fundraising efforts in Canadian, with Canadians like me. He spoke plainly. I've seen him do this several times, and it has always struck me as a little bit unusual. So in our recent conversation, I wondered aloud if this trait I've seen in him was part of the situation around him being thrown in prison. Not kowtowing to or sucking up to people with more power than you have, I would imagine, could create trouble in a variety of settings. Was this a part of what happened in his home country? Yes, I think that's it, he said. And I think I credit the Dominican priests from my childhood for that. Well, I think it's interesting, I answered, that within a conversation about why you were thrown in prison, you were using the word credit rather than the word blame. And he laughed, and then he thought for a minute. I think credit is the right word, he said. Yes, I am definitely grateful to be like this. I'm grateful that he's like this too. It's allowed us to connect at a level that is often hard to accomplish in relationships that happen, as ours originally did, across a wide discrepancy of power. When he and I first became friends, he was here raising money for children of his community to access healthcare and education. Later, I was part of getting him out of prison, and then I was a key part of raising money for his refugee resettlement and his training as a UU minister. To be fully honest, I've always found this a little bit uncomfortable. I like helping people, but I don't like holding too much power in a person's life, especially in a friend's life. It makes it hard to relate genuinely back and forth. And were it not for Fougence's maladaptive trait of not properly appeasing those in power, our friendship would have been stunted by this inequality. As it was, though, we were able to form a genuine connection across the circumstances, which was fortunate because at the time I was trying to help with a not-for-profit project with the Maasai in Kenya. Fougence is not Maasai, but he's worked with them in some of his international work. And as a Westerner with very little cross-cultural experience, I found it invaluable to have the coaching help of an African who was not afraid to tell me the truth. In particular, I remember one lunch between Celeste Fougence and I. I was the outgoing president of the Canadian branch of the not-for-profit Ultimo, the Well Project at the time. And Celeste, who was with us, was the bridge. He grew up Maasai in the village where the Maasai branch of Ultimo was located. Fougence was there as an advisor to coach us, me primarily, prior to Celeste and I going over there. And I made this conscious decision to talk as little as possible during this meeting. To be honest, I make this conscious decision before every meeting, but this time I stuck to it. And as I faded into the woodwork, the meeting shifted. It's hard to describe, but as their awareness of me faded, they began to relate in a way that I've not seen before. There was no agenda. They didn't cover any of the business I thought we were there to discuss. Fougence asked question after question about things that seemed to me to be completely irrelevant, like how hogs were arranged and the ratio of cows to goats. He frequently expressed admiration for the things that the Maasai were doing. He hardly talked about the Ultimo project at all. Later, I asked Fougence about what he was thinking during that conversation. He explained to me that it was the relationship that mattered first, that he and Celeste were getting to know each other. He was learning how the Maasai were solving their problems, and he was earning Celeste's trust that Fougence would listen to him. Success, Fougence said, would look like the Maasai continuing to solve their own problems, with North Americans being involved in ways that took direction from the Maasai and left leadership with them. So this meant a relationship of trust and respect was the first priority. Fougence and I have worked on multiple projects together since then, and we have drifted into his style of doing things. My default is to set up a lot of process to define our roles very clearly, have terms of reference, that sort of thing. Fougence's process is to put a lot of energy into upfront relationship, into finding the right people for the job and building an atmosphere of trust where feedback is given and received freely and it's clear who will do what and when they will ask for help. I find this way of doing things leads to high levels of satisfaction with very low levels of burnout. And so when I created the board for my not-for-profit, Fougence was my top priority to sit on it because I wanted him to teach me to run meetings in this way. But back to Kenya. I've told you many stories over the years about the official business of that trip to Kenya, but there's a side story that I rarely tell. We were in the Jeep driving by the tourist village. This was a village that had been set up where tourists could go and buy beaded jewelry and pay for the Maasai to share their culture and perform traditional songs and dances. Now, I was learning about music in seminary at the time, and in particular about music in indigenous cultures. I was learning about the way it's not easy to separate a song from its context. There are songs for certain rituals and certain types of work. I was learning about the way indigenous cultures, such as the Maasai, can be protective of their music, and the cost to them when it's not treated with respect. And the things I was studying at school made me want to race into that village and explain to the Maasai and the tourists about the dangers inherent in these interactions. The things I had been learning from Fougence, thankfully, were teaching me to trust the Maasai, to weigh their available options and choose the best decision for them. But as the tune wafted towards us, I couldn't resist asking Celeste about this song. I wanted to know the story. What was this song's context? Was it a comfort song? Did it make him think of his mother or an older sibling tucking him into bed at night? Was it a work song? Did it drop memories of him marching with the other boys, shepherding herds of cattle in as the sun set behind them and the smells of the evening meal drifted up on the wind? What part of Maasai life were these songs connected to? What did it mean? Turns out the words to this particular song were, "This is the song we sing for tourists," followed by nonsense gibberish about how cows eat grass. The work tied to this particular tribal tune was the work of singing songs for Westerners so that they would leave with a touching experience of Maasai culture and the Maasai could earn a living and no part of their traditional music would be put into jeopardy. I was so glad I'd asked about this. But this phrase has stayed with me. These are the songs we sing for tourists. They resonate with a story from my own life that I think affects my relationships still to this day. Many years ago as a teenager, I was in foster care, but prior to this, I was homeless. And this was a really formative time in my life. There's something about running out of food and shelter that sears a season of your life into your memory like nothing else. I spent very little of that part of my life physically on the street. I mostly spent it in the homes of friends. This is a hard way to live because as a troubled teen, you have very little to offer a household. I learned to tell a specific kind of story. How grateful I was, how the people who had opened their home to me were so kind and wonderful, how I knew their generosity would allow me to turn my life around. It's a story that had resonances with some of the things that the Maasai said to me many years later. And I know it's an uncomfortable story to tell. It's a story that puts you in the position of constantly being the helped one, never a person with power or something to contribute beyond the promise of your own transformation. And because that transformation for me never really happened, this story was a very fragile thing to have to base your next meal on. The homes I lived in generally lasted 4 to 6 weeks until the story I was telling expired and I had to find a new place to live and a new set of people to play along with. These are the songs we sing for tourists. I vividly remember arriving at Rick and June's house. My moving in was unexpected, so they weren't there to greet me, but they had left me a note. The note said how happy they were to have me, make myself at home, and they'd included a list of chores because everyone under the roof does chores, and if I wanted to stay, I would need to have my shoulder to the wheel like everyone else. I was not being treated like a charity case or a guest or a story, and I was expected to contribute. And I vividly remember this feeling of relief. It was so strong that I felt it as a tingling up and down my arms, and I knew somewhere in my gut that this home would be different. And Rick and June's house was one of two homes that lasted for as long as I needed. It was also one of two homes where I was useful, where the story I lived with was not one of my own incompetence, but strength and an expectation to help out. Ironically, this actually was transformative. It was not just one more temporary shelter. It was a home. I was not there to sing songs for tourists. That experience has taught me so much about the power of pairing help with genuine relationship. The experience also shaped my perspective in the work I do when I'm the one doing the helping. I remember what it feels like to be deep down hungry, and I remember what it feels like to be helped. Sometimes as a flawed creature in need of constant charity, sometimes as a capable creature in need of some tangible supports in solving your own problems, carrying out your own plans. These are two very different types of experiences. I have observed Fujons over and over again making the choice to treat the people he's helping as partners in a common goal with knowledge and abilities that he can't have. And I've seen how effective this is because it maintains people's sense of themselves as problem solvers with control in their own lives. This has informed how I tackle issues across culture and race, including the issue of race itself. I was raised to think of racism as a thing that white people do to black people, and sometimes it is that. But more often, it's a systemic way of thinking that people of all races need to work to dismantle together. And if I think of racism as a thing I am doing to Fujons, I'm a perpetrator and he's a victim. And that's not great for me. It's not great for him either, frankly. When I think of it as a systemic problem that we're working on together, Fujons isn't solely a victim, but also an indispensable asset in the fight. Sometimes, like with my framing Canadian Unitarianism as real Unitarianism, Fujons is the one that notices. Sometimes, like with the suggestion that we hold the board meetings of Flaming Chalice International in French instead of English, so that the Burundian people will be speaking easily and I will be the one struggling, it's been me who's noticed and suggested. Or sometimes, like with the signing of a white person name on a document or creating a worship service that we both knew would reach farther if the stories were told in English with no accent, I'm the one with the most power to do what needs doing. Sometimes, like with earning the trust of the communities we're helping and making wise judgment calls, he's the one with the most power. but the partnership model makes us both so much more effective. Like with Celeste and Fulgence's conversation over lunch, it begins with the establishing of trust. You need to know you will tell each other the truth, even when it's tricky. One side note. The partnership model deals with the very tricky problem of white guilt because it bypasses the question about whether I am being racist. Racism is a thing that exists. Sometimes it works through me, but not because I'm trying to be that way, but because this is what I was taught. This is one of the reasons I don't feel a lot of personal guilt around issues of race, even including my own mistakes. The other reason I don't feel a lot of guilt is about focus, because for as long as we are talking about how racist I am or am not, and whether I should feel guilty, we're putting me as a white person at the center of that conversation. When we're talking instead about the pattern and the impact, we're putting change, we're putting our vision at the center of the conversation. It doesn't matter what is or isn't my fault. It matters what power I have, what role I can take in contributing to change. Nobody expects me not to be racist. The only part that matters is if I can be trusted to hear feedback well and adapt to it. That's what people care about. And guilt is a barrier to that process. It doesn't help it. The partnership way of relating also leads to more effectively addressing problems because it puts less pressure on the powerful person to be wise. The question, how can I most wisely use my privilege to help this person and make the right decisions for them, is very hard to answer. It requires a great deal of imagination and empathy and a little bit of psychic powers. This is why I prefer to ask, how can I transfer some of my privilege to this person so they can help themselves? How can I lend my power in service of what they're trying to do? It's a subtle shift in thinking, but it's a powerful one. But it's more than just that. Because I no longer think of imbalances of privilege as something that hurt the powerless and help the powerful. I used to think that way before I'd had any experience in being on the powerful side of the equation. But now I think that often these imbalances hurt the powerless more, but they hurt both parties. These imbalances are toxic to genuine relationship. They lend themselves to singing songs for tourists. And there is potential, tremendous potential for learning that is lost when that happens. We need that learning. As Unitarians, we need it. Right now, like every religion in North America, we're facing declining attendance and less money and fewer volunteers, and we know we need to change shape. We will need structures that are cheaper, that are easier to run, that are more adaptable. These are the central problems of Unitarianism in this moment, and these are problems that African Unitarians have already largely solved. The organization I run, Mirth and Dignity, bases much of its administrative success on copying the leadership and structural models that I learned from African people, because there's no way I could possibly have set it up the way we do things in North America. I could never have learned what I've learned about this if my approach had been a Westerner there to solve people's problems. Or looking more generally at Canada, we face significant challenges in our culture of epidemic loneliness and a sense of spiritual drift, to say nothing of needing a new way to think about the environment and the kind of world that we're leaving our children. These are problems that traditional Indigenous cultures are particularly good at tackling. They have tools that we could learn a lot from. And so truth, healing, and reconciliation in our country are things we do because they bring justice and a way forward. Dismantling racism is how we give Indigenous people access to all kinds of tools and power that they can use to build the lives they've chosen for themselves. But reconciliation helps all of us. That improved relationship gives non-Indigenous peoples access, too, to less colonial ways of thinking about things, new perspective and new tools. And with all of these things, we can move forward together in a way that allows all of us a stronger foundation to build the lives we want and choose. For ourselves and for our children, for all of our children. We begin then not with solutions, but with relationship and with the creation of trust. Yeah.